You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm your host, William Cooper. Years ago, many, many years ago, in fact, in 1972, I was sitting at my desk at about 4:30 in the morning at the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet, arranging the information that had come in over the last 24 hours into a logical order, so that we could prepare a briefing for the Admiral and his staff, which would take place later that morning. Among the papers I found on my desk was a document entitled Operation Majority, and it was not the entire paperwork involving this operation, but was merely a synopsis of the operation and projects contained under it. One of these projects was called Project Red Light. The purpose, according to this document, was to back engineer captured extraterrestrial technology for adaptation into the United States space program. Now, I have since come to believe that the extraterrestrial portion of all of this is nonsense, but that the technology is real. I believe that many of us were shown these documents over the years, so that later we would talk about it. I mean, how can you keep the existence of extraterrestrials, if they were real, a secret? And how could anyone keep quiet knowing that they had seen documentation, official government documents labeled top secret, that expressed that these extraterrestrials were real and had visited this earth? Well, years later, I wanted to find out just what was true and what was false about all of this. I came forward and told the world what I had seen in those documents. And a strange thing happened, ladies and gentlemen. As long as I tended to agree, and initially I did, as long as I tended to agree that extraterrestrials were real and what these documents said was true, people flocked to me. Everywhere I went to speak, thousands and thousands of people came. It was absolutely incredible. But you see, I didn't leave it there. I wanted to know just how true all of this was, and I began a program of research to find out if extraterrestrials were real. The first thing I did was collect every bit of documentation that I could find, both from the Freedom of Information Act, from the research of others, from books that had been printed on the subject of UFOs, and of course through my network of friends in the intelligence community. What I discovered was amazing. What I discovered, ladies and gentlemen, is that there has been a plan in existence since about 1917, and probably before that, to create an artificial extraterrestrial threat to this earth in order to create a one-world totalitarian socialist government. One of the first documents that I found in my search was this one. The Imperial Japanese Mission, 1917, a record of the reception throughout the United States of the special mission headed by Viscount Ishii. And when the Imperial Japanese Mission was in New York City, they had a dinner, and some pretty famous people spoke at this dinner. One of them was John Dewey. John Dewey is the father of our failing, disastrous public education system. Here's what he said. Listen very carefully. John Dewey, professor of philosophy in Columbia University, who was the next speaker, was listened to with great intentness. He said, quote, "Someone remarked that the best way to unite all the nations on this globe would be an attack from some other planet. In the face of such an alien enemy, people would respond with a sense of their unity of interest and purpose." Unquote. Now, bear in mind, folks, that's 1917. One of the next documents that I found, and I found quite a few, but one that's pretty important is called the Report from Iron Mountain, The Probability and Desirability of Permanent Peace. And I'm going to quote some paragraphs from this report. "Though not yet expressly put forth is the development of a long-range sequence of space research projects with largely unattainable goals. This kind of program offers several advantages lacking in the social welfare model. First, it is unlikely to phase itself out regardless of the predictable surprises science has in store for us. The universe is too big. In the event some individual project unexpectedly succeeds, there would be no dearth of substitute problems. For example, if colonization of the moon proceeds on schedule, it could then become necessary to establish a beachhead on Mars or Jupiter and so on. Second, it need be no more dependent on the general supply-demand economy than its military prototype. Third, it lends itself extraordinarily well to arbitrary control. Space research can be viewed as the nearest modern equivalent yet devised to the pyramid building and similar ritualistic enterprises of ancient societies. It is true that the scientific value of the space program, even of what has already been accomplished, is substantial on its own terms. But current programs are absurdly and obviously disproportionate. In the relationship of the knowledge sought to the expenditures committed, all but a small fraction of the space budget measured by the standards of comparable scientific objectives must be charged de facto to the military economy. Future space research, projected as a war surrogate, would further reduce the scientific rationale of its budget to a minuscule percentage indeed." Now let's go to another section here. Substitutes for the functions of war. In section 3, we pointed out that certain disarmament models, which we called conservative, postulated extremely expensive and elaborate inspection systems. Would it be possible to extend and institutionalize such systems to the point where they might serve as economic surrogates for war spending? The organization of fail-safe inspection machinery could well be ritualized in a manner similar to that of established military processes. Inspection teams might be very like armies, and their technical equipment might be very like weapons. Inflating the inspection budget to military scale presents no difficulty. The appeal of this kind of scheme lies in the comparative ease of transition between two parallel systems. The elaborate inspection surrogate is fundamentally fallacious, however, although it might be economically useful as well as politically necessary during the disarmament transition. It would fail as a substitute for the economic function of war for one simple reason. Peacekeeping inspection is part of a war system, not of a peace system. It implies the possibility of weapons maintenance or manufacture which could not exist in a world at peace as here defined. Massive inspection also implies sanctions and thus war readiness. Now, I encourage you to find this book wherever you can find it. I don't know where you can get it, but find it. It's called The Report from Iron Mountain. And it continues on another page, page 66. Credibility, in fact, lies at the heart of the problem of developing a political substitute for war. This is where the space race proposals, in many ways so well suited as economic substitutes for war, fall short. The most ambitious and unrealistic space project cannot of itself generate a believable external menace. It has been hotly argued that such a menace would offer the last best hope of peace, etc., by uniting mankind against the danger of destruction by creatures from other planets or from outer space. Experiments have been proposed to test the credibility of an out-of-our-world invasion threat. It is possible that a few of the more difficult-to-explain flying saucer incidents of recent years were in fact early experiments of this kind. If so, they could hardly have been judged encouraging. We anticipate no difficulties in making a need for a giant super space program credible for economic purposes, even were there not ample precedent, extending it for political purposes to include features unfortunately associated with science fiction would obviously be a more dubious undertaking. Nevertheless, an effective political substitute for war would require alternate enemies, some of which might seem equally far-fetched in the context of the current war system. It may be, for instance, that gross pollution of the environment can eventually replace the possibility of mass destruction by nuclear weapons as the principal substitute for war. Are you beginning to get the message, folks? Poisoning of the air and of the principal sources of food and water supply is already well advanced, and at first glance would seem promising in this respect. It constitutes a threat that can be dealt with only through social organization and political power. But from present indications, it will be a generation to a generation and a half before environmental pollution, however severe, will be sufficiently menacing on a global scale to offer a possible basis for a solution. It is true that the rate of pollution could be increased selectively for this purpose. In fact, the mere modifying of existing programs for the deterrence of pollution could speed up the process enough to make the threat credible much sooner. But the pollution problem has been so widely publicized in recent years that it seems highly improbable that a program of deliberate environmental poisoning could be implemented in a politically acceptable manner. However unlikely some of the possible alternate enemies we have mentioned may seem, we must emphasize that one must be found of credible quality and magnitude if a transition to peace is ever to come about without social disintegration. It is more probable, in our judgment, that such a threat will have to be invented rather than developed from unknown conditions. For this reason, we believe further speculation about its putative nature ill-advised in this context. Ladies and gentlemen, they have created so many alternate enemies in order to bring about their one world totalitarian socialist state that we don't know which enemy to turn to, which enemy to believe is real or is false, or whether to just toss them all out on their ears. And I think that that is probably going to be the best solution. Disarmament is no accident. All of these bills in Congress to take away our weapons is no accident. The intentional environmental pollution of our lakes, rivers, streams, oceans, forests, everything is no accident, as you just heard. These things were planned many, many years ago. All the bombardment of the public with movies about flying saucers in the 50s, right after the United Nations Treaty was signed and the UN Participation Act was pushed through Congress. And all of the incidents since that have convinced the majority of the American people that flying saucers are real and extraterrestrials exist, and that flying saucers are from an extraterrestrial origin. Don't believe it? Look at the last Gallup poll that asked the question, do you believe extraterrestrials are real, and do you believe that they have visited the Earth? Do you believe that UFOs are extraterrestrial in origin? The answer to all of those questions was overwhelmingly to the positive, or yes. This is a product of the inculcation into the collective minds of the people of the world that flying saucers are real and that they are of extraterrestrial origin. This is being promulgated in many ways by television commercials, in the movies, in the newspapers, by creating incidents either real or imagined, either promulgated are of genuine extraterrestrial origin. You see, we, the average everyday Joe Blow, has no capability whatsoever to find out whether this is real or whether it is just another ruse to bring about the New World Order. I believe, because of my research and because of the extensive documentation that I have found and that is in my book, that this whole scenario has been created to give us an artificial alien threat from outer space. During the Reagan administration, he made 6 speeches. At the ends of these speeches, I mean, he made more than 6 speeches during his administration. I don't want you to think he just made 6. But he made 6 which specifically talked about a threat from outer space by some other species from some other planet. 6, ladies and gentlemen. Why would the president repeat the same thing 6 times tagged on to the ends of speeches by him? The speech writers did not put that in the speech. Ronald Reagan added it himself. One memorable television broadcast of Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev together, Ronald Reagan stated that they had agreed in private that if the Earth was attacked by some other species from some other planet, the United States and the Soviet Union would combine their military forces to repel such an invasion. Mikhail Gorbachev walked to the microphone and said, although he could not foresee anything like this happening in the near future, if it did, that Ronald Reagan was right, we would combine our military forces to repel such an invasion. Coming from the leaders of the 2 greatest, most powerful nations on the face of this earth, this was a powerful suggestion to implant into the minds of the people of the world that there really is a threat from some other species, from some other planet to this earth. Now, is that true? Or is this just a part of a plan to make us believe in this threat in order to get us to put away our national boundaries, to accept whatever sacrifices are called upon us to accept in order to face this threat from outer space? Now, you people out there have been ignoring the UFO phenomenon for too long. You have been ignoring this abductee phenomenon for too long. It has all the earmarks of the most successful, most sophisticated mind control operation in the history of the world, and you are ignoring it. What better way to implement a plan to bring about a one world government than to create the possibility in the minds of the people of the world that we are being threatened from some other species, from some other planet, and do it in a way that if anybody questioned it or challenged it or wants to talk about it publicly, that they are ridiculed. Yet, the idea persists despite the ridicule. And what if, ladies and gentlemen, the government is not keeping anything secret from us? What if, when they tell us that UFOs are no concern to the government or the military because they do not pose a threat to the national security, what if they're telling us the truth? What if they're telling us the truth because it's their technology? It's our technology, and there are no extraterrestrials. Therefore, it does not impose a threat to the national security. But yet the very idea of the government telling us that implants in our minds that the government is withholding information on UFOs. And that could also be true, but in a way that you would never expect. You see, when they tell you UFOs do not exist or can be explained away as natural occurrences and natural explanations, they could be telling us the truth. For you see, to them, there are no UFOs. To them, this technology is understood and clearly identified as being theirs. So when you ask them a question about UFOs and they say there are no UFOs, UFOs do not pose a threat to the national security, ladies and gentlemen, I believe they are telling us the truth in the context of the information that I have just given you. Do we have such advanced technology? Are there secret military bases called Area, or one called Area 51? Could there be a mesa somewhere with the airfield of the future built into it, from which flying discs using a new propulsion technology make forays out into the night? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I believe that there is. And I have proven the existence of one in my video documentary called Project Red Light, and then again in Project Red Light 2. Project Red Light is no longer available, but Project Red Light 2 certainly is. And if you write in and ask for information, we'll send you an information pack telling you how you can get a copy of that video documentary. This base exists in the desert of Nevada on land allotted to the Atomic Energy Commission, the most super secret agency that there is. So finding out anything about this area called Area 51 or Groom Dry Lake is next to impossible. When we tried to get satellite photographs of the area, we could not obtain any from the United States of America. So we went to the Soviet Union and obtained a satellite photograph of the Groom Dry Lake facility, a facility that up until recently the United States government and all its agencies denied existed. No one would take credit for it. No one would tell us who operated this facility. No one would tell us what was out there. But when we got this satellite photograph from the Soviet Union, there it was, a facility, a runway over 30,000 feet long on a dry lake bed, huge hangars. You could clearly see MiGs and other aircraft on the tarmac. And there is no doubt that it exists. Now, let me read to you something here, folks, that's extremely important, because there is a technology flying in our sky that you don't know about. You see, quite a while ago in California, they began to have these strange earthquakes. But they weren't really earthquakes. You see, they were skyquakes. They were caused by some tremendous sonic boom of some tremendously fast aircraft flying at a very high altitude that nobody could see. It was tracked by the ground control approach people at the San Francisco facilities as coming from the Nevada desert in the vicinity of the Groom Dry Lake area, and went off their radar screens at the very top of the atmosphere. Now, don't ask me what that means. Did it go into space? Did it disappear? Did it go into another dimension? I don't know, ladies and gentlemen. I don't have all the answers. I just have an awful lot of clues. Now, these sonic booms are measurable on seismographs, the ones that measure earthquakes. I'm holding in my hand a seismic profile of the recent skyquakes, and this was provided by Jim Morey of Caltech to researcher Victor Martinez. The first indicated mark, actually lying under the 610 time marker, is that recorded by the Catalina Island seismograph. The second, slightly before 611, is that recorded by the Mount Wilson seismograph. Careful scaling, folks, of the original printout indicated that the two skyquakes were 52.5 seconds apart. The two recording seismographs, Catalina Island and Mount Wilson, are nominally 64 miles apart. Thus, the vehicle causing the skyquakes traveled the 64 miles at an average speed of 1.219 miles per second, or 4,388.57 miles per hour. At 40,000 feet, folks, the speed of sound is 640 miles per hour at standard temperature and pressure. Dividing 4,388.57 by 640 yields Mach 6.857. It's time to take our break. Don't go away, folks. I'll be right back after this very short pause. Orange County Register, May the 24th, 1993, UFO sightings reported near San Francisco. A dozen people tell of seeing X-shaped craft by Jeff Sklansky, Associated Press. San Francisco. More than a dozen people said they saw a UFO racing across the pre-dawn sky north of San Francisco on Thursday, a strange X-shaped craft with blinking lights that hovered above the hills of Sonoma County before speeding away into the dark. A California Highway Patrol officer who declined to be named and radio station KTOB news director Arlette Cohen were among those who reported spotting the strange craft at about 4:30 a.m. between the cities of Petaluma and Sonoma, about 40 miles north of San Francisco. The sightings came on the heels of reports of multicolored UFOs the size of ping pong balls crowding radar screens in Sao Paulo, Brazil. The government scrambled jet fighters to intercept the tiny objects, and two pilots said they saw the objects flying nearby. Quote, "I saw these two white lights to the east," unquote, Cohen said, estimating the craft was about 1,000 feet in the air. She said she noticed the UFO when it crossed to the west side of the highway and hovered almost stock still for a few seconds, unquote. Cohen said she was driving to work at her Petaluma station northbound on US 101 and made the sighting shortly before reaching Petaluma. When the craft crossed the highway once again, she said she saw two tiny green lights glowing faintly on the side opposite the two bright white lights. She said she could hear no sound coming from the craft. Quote, "I think I saw sort of a black X silhouette shape," Cohen said. "It was really hard to tell," unquote. An unidentified object described as a large orange X with white lights in the front was seen traveling at a high rate of speed eastbound from Petaluma, Santa Rosa, California Highway Patrol Officer Bill McChristian said of the report from the unidentified officer and several callers. San Francisco Bay Area air traffic controllers said they could not explain the sighting, saying radar screens detected no such object flying over the area at that time. The North American Aerospace Defense Command in Colorado said no man-made spacecraft would have been visible at 4:30 a.m. in Northern California, but that debris from the Cosmos 1683 satellite reportedly re-entered the atmosphere over California more than an hour later at 5:41. Meanwhile, Brazil's Air Force said it has ordered an investigation into the sighting of tiny balls of light that flew through Brazilian skies at 900 miles an hour and evaded Air Force planes sent up to chase them. "We are looking for a technical explanation for these phenomena. So far, we don't have any," the Air Force Ministry's press office said in Brasilia, the capital. The objects were first sighted Monday night by a private plane near Sao Jose dos Campos, an industrial city 210 miles southwest of Rio de Janeiro. The Air Force Minister, General Octavio Moreira Lima, said the objects soon were saturating radar and interfering with air traffic. In Sao Jose dos Campos and nearby Sao Paulo's Brazil's biggest city. Lima said the Air Force sent up three French-built Mirage III fighters and two United States-made F-5E jets to chase the objects, which he described as multicolored balls of light. Instead, the objects pursued one of the planes, he said. One of the pilots reported that 13 of the objects accompanied his aircraft, seven on one side and six on the other, the minister said. The Air Force jets, which confirmed the presence of the UFOs on their radar screens, reportedly flew after the objects for 3 hours until low fuel forced them to return to base. Astronomer Larry Brown of the Hayden Planetarium in New York on Thursday did offer one possible explanation. "It may have something to do with the recent passage of Halley's Comet. There's a lot of dust in the air, and when it hits the Earth's atmosphere, it burns brightly." And this is the kind of bullshit that they throw at us. Now, you just heard the reports of all those people, the reports of the jet pilots, and this guy says that it may have something to do with Halley's Comet. There's a lot of dust in the air, and when it hits the Earth's atmosphere, it burns brightly. Wake up, people. Not bird, not plane. Orange County Register 3593. A strange, unidentified flying object was observed for more than an hour in the sky over Shanghai on Tuesday, the Zenmin Evening News said Thursday. The newspaper quoted witnesses who said they first saw an orange-colored, man-shaped object at 7:05 p.m. After 20 minutes, the figure's head radiated red light and its body glowed yellow as it sent out green tendrils, the newspaper said. Slowly, the figure changed into a giant mushroom and eventually disappeared. Now, you may be sitting there laughing, folks, but hundreds of people witnessed this happen in the sky. Holographic projection? Possibly. Secret technology, possibly. Extraterrestrial visitation, that also is a possibility. Although, if my television set was broken, I would not travel 400 light years away to find the answer, or even 2 light years away to find the answer. I believe the answer to all of this is right here on this earth. I think a lot of us are being used, abused, a lot of disinformation, lies, and other assorted stuff being thrown at us to convince us that there's an extraterrestrial threat. Here's from the Daily Pilot, 5/24, looks like 1986. Pilot pursued pulsating lights. Brasilia, Brazil. An Air Force pilot confirmed Friday he had chased UFOs he described as pulsating colored balls of light over the skies of southeastern Brazil early this week and said they couldn't be anything now existing. Lieutenant Kleber Caldas Marino, 25, said he pursued but could not catch the flying objects, first sighted in the southeastern city of São José dos Campos on Monday night. It was a pulsating light, red and white, mostly white, Marino said at a press conference at Air Force headquarters in the capital. It was not a star. It couldn't have been another plane. It couldn't be anything now existing, he said. The pilot said his United States-made F-5E fighter approached to within 12 miles of one of the objects, but had to turn back because he was running low on fuel. Captain Marcio Jordao, 29, another F-5E pilot, said he saw a red light that didn't vary but evidently was moving. I got to within 25 miles, but I couldn't go any faster. Visibility was great. There were no clouds or other aircraft traffic. The objects were picked up on radar screens in 3 states in southeastern Brazil, the Air Force said. Here's the Daily Pilot, page A4, May the 23rd, 1986. X-shaped UFO seen by several above Bay Area. San Francisco, more than a dozen people said they saw a mysterious UFO racing across the pre-dawn sky north of San Francisco on Thursday, and on and on and on and on and on. Here is Brazilian jets chase multicolored UFOs, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, multicolored UFOs the size of ping pong balls, and on and on and on and on. 8/14/86, the Orange County Register, man-made object probably caused mysterious light. The mysterious light seen in the sky in the eastern third of North America coincided with a meteor shower, but some astronomers say it probably was made by a man-made object such as a satellite. The light, described as a pinpoint, a spiral or a glowing cloud, was seen from Louisiana to Canada about 10 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time Tuesday. A Canadian scientist said the light was sparked by debris from an unidentified satellite. Paul Olas, the director of the Buell Science Center in Pittsburgh, agreed that the lights probably were caused by a man-made object. He speculated the lights came from a release of gas from a satellite orbiting the planet. But Ronald Stoner, physics and astronomy professor at Ohio's Bowling Green State University, said he suspected the display was caused by the meteor shower. Workers at space facilities all confirmed that no satellites were launched Tuesday. And we could go on and on and on and on for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours, but we're not going to do that, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I went to the desert, have been going for many, many years, out to the area known as Area 51, Groom Dry Lake. For a lot of years that I went, I could climb to the top of the Groom Mountain and look down, or any of the mountains around the area, and look down and watch these craft fly up the valley to the north from the test site. The United States Air Force, apparently realizing that many of us were doing this, made an illegal land grab. They literally stole the land and put it behind signs that said military installation, keep off. And it cited the National Security Act of 1954 as authority to do this. Well, that was taken to court by many people who owned part of that land, had mining claims, and most of it was public land belonging to the Bureau of Land Management. the true reason for confiscating the land never came out in court, and all of that documentation was classified and only viewed by the judge in chambers. So the public still doesn't know why they did that. Ostensibly, it's to protect secret projects from the scrutiny of foreign nations. And those of us who have really studied this veil of secrecy know that it's really to keep a secret from the American people. Because our greatest enemies have the capability to look down on it and record everything that happens there by satellite, and have had that capability for many, many years. Nothing happens there that is secret from any other government that has the capability to put a satellite in orbit and look down upon the earth. So, the ruse that it was to hide it from the Soviet Union is a lie. The truth is that they're hiding it from the United States citizens, whatever it is that goes on there. Now, I've gone out there many times, and you can go too, but I advise you to be very careful. Don't go any place except where I tell you on this program right now, and you'll be safe and you won't get in any trouble. Take Highway 93 north from Las Vegas. You'll notice that for long stretches of highway and for long periods of time, you will be the only car out there. You won't see anybody else. For many years, this was one of the most desolate spots on this North American continent. And that's why they put these test sites out there, because nobody ever went there. Just after going through a little town called Alamo, you will reach an intersection of Highway 375 and 93. Turn left on Highway 375, and within just a couple of blocks, a quarter of a mile probably, you will reach another Y in the road. Take the left fork and continue on Highway 375 up over the top of a mountain, and when you get to the top, you will notice that there's a sign there that says Hancock Summit. Go down the other side, ladies and gentlemen, and you will be looking down on the Tickaboo Valley. The Tickaboo Valley. You will notice that this valley is absolutely desolate. Nothing there except a small ranch right about in the middle of this valley. And as you travel across the valley on Highway 375, look to the left. Keep looking to the left, right beside the road, you'll see a mailbox, a black mailbox. Now, if you continue on Highway 375, you'll go over the top of another little mountain called Coyote Summit. And as you go down the other side, you'll see that there is a mobile home town just right there in the middle of nowhere. And most of these people who live in that little town called Rachel work at or for the test site. Some of them are prospectors. Some of them run little businesses there. And on the other side of the town, you will see a place called the Little Ailey Inn. You can get a room there. I suggest you call in advance, Rachel, Nevada, Little Ailey Inn. The area code is 702. Call the information operator. They'll give you the number. Talk to Pat or Joe. Tell them I send them my love, and ask for a reservation for a room before you go for the nights that you're going to be going. Now, I recommend, folks, that if you want to see this technology fly, that you take at least a week. 3 days at the least, because you don't know when they're going to fly these things, and nobody does either, and don't listen to these rumors that they always fly on Wednesday night or Friday night, or at 4:15 in the morning, you can always see it, because that is a crock. It's not true. You'll be lucky if you see it, but the longer you stay, the more apt you are to see this technology actually flying in the air. You're going to have to sleep during the daytime and go back to the mailbox at night. Park at the mailbox alongside Highway 375. Don't touch the mailbox. Don't poke holes in it. Don't try to open it. It belongs to Steve Medlin, who owns the ranch in the middle of the valley. You wouldn't like someone tampering with your mail or your private property, and I can tell you for a fact that Steve isn't going to like it either. Don't bother Steve at the ranch, and don't go anyplace else except that mailbox. Now, you should have a map of the Nevada area which shows the location of Groom Dry Lake. Standing at that mailbox, get out your map, look for the direction from that mailbox where you can find Groom Dry Lake, and just look in that direction with, you'll need a set of good high-power binoculars, and if you're going to take photographs, you'll need good quality telephoto lenses. Now, folks, if you got the time, you go sleep all day, you go spend all night at that spot. Don't go to sleep, because the minute you go to sleep, they're going to fly that craft. Believe me, it's happened to me many times. If you go in the wintertime, it's extremely cold at night on the desert, well below freezing. Make sure that you take plenty of warm clothing. Now, if you don't go anywhere else but the places that I've just told you, you will not be in any danger, you will not have any problems, you will not be hassled by any law enforcement people or the goon security from Wackenhut who patrol that BLM land there where they have no authority. But if you go off the main road and you go toward the test site, even though you're on public land, these people have been known to be very intimidating. They like to wave guns around, and sometimes they have confiscated people's cameras and threaten them with arrest and all kinds of things. One thing you must understand, they have no authority outside the boundary of the test site. And if you know this and you stack up for your rights, the only thing that will happen is they will call the local sheriff, who will come out from Alamo, and he will ask you politely not to antagonize the security force and stay out of that area. And if you're listening to me, you won't go in there anyway. Okay? When we go wherever we want to go, as long as we stay out of the bounds of the test site, because we know how to deal with these people. We know our rights. We carry a copy of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights with us. We make extensive preparations before we go, telling people what our itinerary is. We send sealed letters of our itinerary and our intent to the Lincoln County Sheriff and to all of the news media in the state of Nevada and in our home state. We protect ourselves. Now, I don't know if you know how to do all of that. If you do, then we strongly suggest that you use these techniques. If you don't, then as long as you do exactly what I've told you to do and nothing else, you will not get in any trouble. Now, watching these disc-shaped craft fly in the sky is an incredible experience. Now, if you can't take the trip, ladies and gentlemen, we have a video which is, I believe, about an hour and 41 minutes long, which shows you the entire area. We have filmed on videotape these craft flying in the air at night, sometimes with helicopters flying around them, and they make the helicopters look like ants next to a cow. They're huge. We also have on this videotape the only video that I know of in existence of a huge cigar-shaped craft hovering in daylight over the test site, and it moves into a cloud bank and disappears. It's incredible video footage that we got. We also have footage of the black helicopters and of the little alien and even some of the aircraft flying in their maneuvers, which are incredible. We've been literally knocked to the ground by jet fighters flying just a few feet above the ground, who flew right over us on one occasion. So if you want to go and have fun. If you can't go and you want to order our video documentary, order Project Red Light 2. If you're a CAGI member, it's $35 postpaid. If you're not a CAGI member, it's $75 postpaid. Folks, I hope you've enjoyed tonight's program. Please wake up. Please don't ignore this UFO business or this abductee business, and we may talk about abductees on other nights. It's serious. And it's causing us to think in a way that could be dangerous to our individual freedoms. Call Swiss America Trading right now, folks. Don't forget, call Swiss America Trading right now. 1-800-X. That's 1-800-289. You'll be glad that you did. Good night, and God bless you all.